All right, we got a lot of stuff to get to here. We got a nice long segment to do it, and we will get to the stuff we teased. I'm mixing a few texts here as long as we're out here live at Texans training camp. Sean Pendergast, Seth Payne with you here on a Thursday. Sun coming up here at the Methodist Training Center. Good morning, guys. Agree with you that I don't believe Nick is spending recklessly. With regards to Higgins, Texans traded out of the first round, so they didn't have to give that first-round money. I repeat, they did not pay for a first-round pick. So why not pay full price for a second pick in the second round that was going to be close to 100% anyways? Great job, Nick. I feel like I'm reading a modified version of the DeAndre Hopkins memo with that text.
Yeah, right. I don't know if if that's what he's going for or not. It's one of those things where you agree with me, but I don't think for all the right reasons. You don't go into a used car lot and say, like, huh. Boy, according to Kelly Blue Book, this should be actually $1,000 more expensive. So here you go.
Yeah.
whatever the opposite of looking a gift horse in the mouth is. This is like, no, I'm gonna give the gift horse my firstborn child. Yeah, it's somewhere in between. I think that Nick, I've told you before, there's a lot of the ways that Nick negotiates that I like, because it's win-win negotiating. Where when you're negotiating with people who are going to be your employees, it's different than when you're negotiating with somebody where you're, say, buying a car, where it's a
transaction.
One-off transaction.
Yep.
Yeah, or buying a house.
Yep.
Buying a house, you know what? You don't give a damn what the owner needs in the future moving forward. You just want to buy that house at the best possible price.
That's a great point. Yep.
When you're dealing with an employee, that's a whole different deal, because you want to be sure you've got a good relationship moving forward. And I think Nick, because I've heard some people kind of frame it as that he doesn't want the confrontation or whatever. And I don't think that's the furthest from the truth. If you think about the fact that Nick was able to manage with Deshaun Watson in that scenario, which was the most uncomfortable thing ever. And, you know, just flat out said, no, Deshaun, oh, it's uncomfortable? Okay, but you're going to go out to practice, because we can get you for conduct detrimental if you don't go out to practice while you're undergoing all this. Like, that was very, very uncomfortable. So I don't think Nick shies away from discomfort. It's that sometimes, as we're going to find out as we talk about the Cowboys, sometimes you allow all that contentiousness all over the place, and it seeps over into the culture of your football team.
Yeah. You're right. That's a good segue into Micah Parsons talk here. Be glad that the Texans, I feel like, be glad they handle business the way that they do. Because when you don't, when you delay, this is what happens. Here's Micah Parsons, who Adam Schefter said earlier this week, we played the audio yesterday, that the Cowboys have yet to make an offer to Micah Parsons. So I don't know what they're
and
doing.
Remember, Jerry at one point said he didn't know Micah Parsons' agent's name.
Yeah.
Who's David Mulligetta, one of the more prominent agents. I feel like, and I believe it. I think Jerry, if you weren't doing business in the 1990s, Jerry doesn't know anything about you or anything in general.
I think you're right. So here's Micah Parsons again. Hasn't been made an offer yet by the Cowboys. And this is not one of these things where it's after year three. We're in. Micah Parsons is heading into his fifth season, and we're talking about this right now. Here's Micah Parsons on his contract situation.
Because like I said, my agent's been reaching out. As at one point, another grown man has to be willing to reach out as itself. You know what I mean? Like, communication worked both ways. They reached out, you know, so that needs to happen too. They got to want to do it on their part.
David reached out to the Joneses?
Yeah, for sure. David, I mean, not the Joneses, but Adam, whoever the little in-betweener is, you know how they do it.
Do you feel like the Cowboys want to get a deal done now?
I mean, honestly, for me, it really don't matter. Like I said, I've been pretty consistent. If they don't want me here, they don't want me here. I'll go about my business. I understand the nature of the business. Like I said, as long as I'm here and under contract, I'm going to do what I have to do to perform at the highest level. But if this is the end, this is the end. You know, there's same way that Jerry Jones and Stephen Jones and the other Jerry Jones take care of their family, it's the same way I need to take care of my family. You know what I mean? I got my own three kids of my own, so we all need to take care of our own family at the end of the day.
I give Micah Parsons, Seth, I give him a lot of credit for the way he's handling this, that he's in camp and practicing. Like, he's not missed a minute of the things that have been mandatory that he needs to be at throughout this whole thing. Like, he's heading into his fifth year. He has been unquestionably one of the best players in football over the course of his career thus far. I think just listening to Micah there and knowing where the Cowboys are right now, understanding that the Cowboys have been at this stage with Dak Prescott and CeeDee Lamb and probably others that have been a little lower profile, I feel like there's as good a chance that Micah Parsons could get traded at the trade deadline if the Cowboys are 3-6 as there is that he's getting a $40 million deal before week one. Like, I feel like anything is in play, including him walking in free agency after this year. I feel like everything's in play right now.
This is the first time that he's really come out and just sounded critical of the organization, other than, you know, trying to clarify when the Cowboys tried to make it look like they just wanted to talk to Micah one-on-one. And Micah had to clarify things and say, like, I don't know what they're talking about. They remember the Cowboys claimed that they basically had a deal already worked out.
Yeah.
And Micah had to say, well, wait a second. No, I've got a professional, my agent, who handles this type of stuff and advises me, and he hasn't given the go-ahead on this, so I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah. I'm just glad. Well, I say I'm glad. I mean, look, for our radio counterparts up in Dallas, this is just like filet mignon medium rare.
this is the problem with Jerry. It's that Jerry, he wants to play hardball, but he always caves at the end. So it ends up costing the organization. Because I could see a lot of people probably saying, look, okay, Micah's under contract. Hey, Seth, weren't you just saying that the GM's got to be comfortable with uncomfortable situations? Yeah. The problem is Jerry has a long, long history now of letting these things fester, creating all the potential bad blood and what have you, and then ultimately giving a contract one or two years later to a Dak Prescott or a CeeDee Lamb or somebody else that's tens of millions of dollars more than if they had just taken care of it in the beginning.
Yeah,
so
dude,
you genuinely like it. So the other part of it is like, okay, man, you got to poop or get off the pot at some point. Trade him. If you're going to be the guy that lets it fester and linger and create distractions, then at some point get really good compensation for the guy. And Jerry always chooses neither of those. He just pays premium dollars eventually after making it go way longer than it needs to.
Yeah, I can boil it down real simple. This isn't what good football teams do, period. Like, if you're a Cowboy, this just isn't what good football teams do.
If I were a Cowboys fan, one of the most depressing graphics I would have seen over the last couple of years is there was one. It was a really nice graph that somebody put out where it showed how much teams, how many points teams have scored over the last 5 years. And they're the Cowboys right at 3 or 4, I think.
Yeah.
And yet have nothing to show for it. You look at all the other teams at the top of that graph, and they've made pushes in the playoffs, and the Cowboys just have done none of it.
There's a number I saw, Seth, and I'd have to go back and verify this. I hope I'm not butchering it. But maybe I'm butchering the exact numbers, but I think what I'm about to lay out feels right, where the Cowboys have had something like, of their last 15 first-round picks, 10 of them have been all-pro first or second team. And when you think about that, I mean, 15 goes back a ways, but think about who they've drafted. Like, they've drafted, obviously, Micah Parsons and CeeDee Lamb and Ezekiel Elliott, to go back that far. Even like Travis Frederick was a late first-round pick. He was an all-pro center at one point. The one thing that you want to do as an NFL team, I think, if you could give any GM, you can pick one thing that you do really, really well, what would it be? I think it would be talent evaluation coming out of college, because those are the guys that are your cheap labor to be able to supplement the expensive guys that you have. Those are the guys, especially with a team like the Texans, that I think really values the intel that you get on having a guy in your building and being able to watch them operate, have them come through your developmental system and things like that. And the Cowboys might be, especially at the tippy top, and even in the middle rounds. Dak Prescott was a fourth-round pick. You know, they've done well in the middle rounds, too. I don't know that you'd be hard-pressed to find a team that's drafted better than the Cowboys for the last decade. And to your point, drafted really well, scored a ton of points, nothing to show for it. Zero.
Right. And no, that's, they've done it. That's why when the Booker, the guard from Alabama, went to the Cowboys, that's why I thought, ah, crap. Because Booker was one of those guys that did not test well. People thought initially, oh, yeah, he's a slam dunk first rounder. And then he didn't do really well in his testing. And in all the mock drafts, he slides down in the second round. And I'm sitting there looking at him like, I don't know. I think he's just a good football player, and he's a guard. I don't I don't care nearly as much about the athleticism of interior offensive linemen. Lo and behold, the Cowboys, who have been really, really good at drafting and drafting offensive linemen specifically, they go ahead and draft Booker. And now they're probably going to get a good player in Booker, but they're also probably going to have some kind of they're going to botch it somehow.
Oh yeah, let's screw
it
up.
And they're not going to end up using him to the best of his abilities.
They'll just mark it on your calendar. He'll be in a contract dispute in 4 years. Yeah.
McClay there, they must, I'm guessing they're paying their director of personnel, Will McClay, right?
Yes.
Very, very well, because he's put together some really talented rosters, but the problem is he's got a GM above him. I mean, he should be the GM. He should be the one making these decisions, but Jerry just can't, he just can't give the keys up.
No.
He's going to drive his car off a cliff every single year. It's like Groundhog Day. You know,
it's
like Groundhog Day. It's like if you're watching Groundhog Day, except Bill Murray was totally cool with the situation. Like, oh, all right,
yeah.
I like doing the same thing over and over and over again. Yeah.
Did you see the cut from Jerry this week where he was basically saying, "Well, we don't even know how many games we're going to have Micah for if we sign him." You know, like I'm sure he saw that.
And Dak Prescott too.
Dak basically looked like
paying Dak Prescott ended up being dumb. Like, well, if you had paid him, honestly, for everything that you would have, if you had handled the Dak Prescott situation the way other teams have, you wouldn't be complaining about his contract right now.
No.
You're complaining about the contract that you had to give because you waited and waited and waited on taking care of the situation.
Dak would be making $10 million less if you had just done business the way every other NFL team does business. Dan Orlovsky, as we make our list heading into the season of people in the national media that are on our side or not on our side, Dan Orlovsky, between his love for C.J. Stroud, we remember last week that was his number one issue with ESPN's top 10 list of quarterbacks was C.J. Stroud was not on it. Now here comes Dan Orlovsky on ESPN this week saying he loves the Houston Texans.
I think Houston's going to be awesome this year. I think Houston has like a little bit of a massive bounce back year. Their defense is absolutely loaded.
Nasty.
And there's a little bit of a mix and match with their offensive line. They missed or moved on like three or four pieces. New offensive coordinator. I think they're going to be awesome this year. Everyone stupidly talked about this regression for C.J. Stroud last year. His numbers weren't all that different than they were his rookie year. More interceptions, no doubt, but offensive line was bottom five in the NFL. He's lost his number one, number two, number three wide receiver. So I think that football team is
going to be tough here.
Absolutely.
That'll hurt.
Yeah. I think it's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, I can't wait to watch. Dude, this defense is going to be fun.
The defense, and we've talked about this multiple times, it's really the one little minor detail that they need to figure out is not allowing all these huge touchdown passes and big plays, because for all of the really good things that they do, they're in the top three in plays made behind the line in the scrimmage, tackles for loss, top five in sacks, quarterback hit, like all these things they're very, very good at. They just have some of these lapses in the secondary and at the linebacker position at time and with tackling that keep them from preventing as much points as the genuinely really elite defenses. So I joke when I say it's a minor detail, but some of it is that you had so much youth on the back end last year. You had two rookies starting in your secondary. Mm-hmm. You had Henry Toa still coming into his own, you know, and he bit at times on play action where it hurt them, that if they can just be a little bit more sound, That's how close they are to being a genuinely top-tier elite. And I mean by top-tier, I mean top-three defense.
Yes.
And it's a lot of it is simply, you know, becoming more veteran.
We should mention, Seth, as long as we're talking about the defense, Christian Harris not on the PUP list, not at practice yesterday either. So
yeah,
you talk about Groundhog Day. It had that feel yesterday, a little bit more of an informed Groundhog Day this year than last year, when we're like, hey, hang on a second, where is Christian Harris? Now we were looking for it this year. Like, okay, now like where's 48? Again, he's not on the PUP list, that which is a cause for optimism. But again, whatever it is he's dealing with was enough to keep him away from the practice field. I mean, this may just be how they're managing him. He may feel perfectly fine, and he's getting a different schedule than everybody else. But it needs to be noted, because he's a guy we get asked about a lot. Christian Harris not at practice yesterday.
And I think we've reached the point where this is where they are their most Astros-like, because they'll tell us, as they've told, you know, as they said in training camp last year, yeah, he'll be fine. He'll be ready to go. We just haven't seen him out there. I mean, we're getting closer and closer where I'm almost mentally just almost assuming that you can't rely on Christian Harris to be yes. out there. I'm not saying that as a criticism of him as a person or individual
or
anything.
It is what
it's
it
his
is.
His calf.
Right.
I can't yeah. rely on his calf. Okay, you're load managing him. All right. Well, whatever situation you're in, where the load management includes not participating in OTAs mm-hmm. and not being out there in the first day of training camp,
yep.
that's some pretty damn aggressive load managing
yeah.
and being hyper conservative about him coming back from the calf, which tells you that yeah, that calf is a medical mystery and they can't quite figure it out.
Man.
So I can't in my mind, if I'm doing a depth chart right now, I can't in good conscience put Christian Harris there.
Nope. No, if Christian
we were,
Harris,
by the way, that did you see the ESPN roster rankings where they had Danico Autry as one of the starting linebackers?
They said Edge. They had Edge next to his name.
It was at linebacker, the one I was looking at. They had the actual depth chart. Depth chart, they had him as a linebacker.
Oh, are you saying on the depth chart they did? Okay, I saw
yes.
starting lineup. He's Edge.
No. They had him as maybe they corrected it by the time you saw it.
Yeah.
But they had a 4-3 listed, and they had four defensive linemen, and then one of the linebackers in the 4-3.
Dude,
this isn't like an edge rushing outside linebacker. This is a 4-3 where it's an off ball linebacker.
The one I saw some people. I think they may have corrected it because I saw some people
yeah.
saying what you were. Did you see they had him listed as a linebacker? And I went and looked, and by the time I looked, they had him at edge. To me, the worst thing was, and
still
you pointed this out to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. To me. The worst thing was that they had Jimmy Ward listed as a starting safety when the very same outlet has Kalen Bullock getting votes from executives and scouts about how he might be one of the 15 best safeties in football, and he's not even in the starting lineup on ESPN's roster rankings.
And Jimmy Ward at this point may or may not be wearing an ankle monitor. We don't know. Like, he's not. They should put that on the injury report, ankle monitor.
Just put ankle. Oh, Jimmy's got an ankle. Okay. Yeah.
Like, hey, why is the team on this practice field today? Well, the geo fence actually stops midway through the facility, so we got to be sure we're practicing closer to the fans today. Yeah.
That's tremendous. Hey, Nick Caley's offense was a big topic out here yesterday. The offensive line we talked about a little bit earlier. C.J. Stroud having more control in this system now than he had with Bobby Slowick's offense. Let's hear from C.J. first, then DeMeco. Here's C.J. on working with Nick Caley.
Yeah, Nick is a fiery young coach who like loves to yell and run around, and you know, and I love it. You know, he brings juice to the building every day. So I'm excited just to work with him every day and try to build a relationship. And he's done a good job of just relating to the players and always asking us what we want, how we want to do things, and making it player-owned. So I love that of him.
That's the second time CJ's talked publicly about Nick Caley, where the first thing he talks about, he just makes him sound like a maniac. Like, he loves to run around and yell.
He sounds a lot like Mike Vrabel. Same. You kind of like, he's fun to watch at practice because he's all over the place. He's everywhere all at once.
Yep.
As you become a grizzled old man who's seen it all, I think this is where Nick Caserio and I are most similar. You start hearing about people gushing about personality traits and everything during training camp, and you're like, okay, yeah, but at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. I mean, Tony Dungy was not a fiery, up-tempo, peppy guy or whatever, and it didn't matter. Like, the personality I will never sit here in July and August and say, well, hey, Nick Caley's got the opposite personality of Bobby Slowick, so it's off to the races, and here we go. We got to see him actually prove it on the field.
Yep, for sure. Here was DeMeco Ryans yesterday saying that. Well, actually, Ben, you know what? Ben, if you're listening, let's do Stroud first and then DeMeco here, since we're coming off of CJ. Here's CJ Stroud talking about having more ownership in this offense, particularly at the line of scrimmage.
Yeah, I mean, this is more of a, quarterback's offense where, you're RDing, you're calling the shots, you're switching protections if you need, and it's really like just me in the center. So that's J-Pat or Juice. Got to have good communication with those guys and, relay to everybody else what's going on. So, Nick is doing a great job teaching us the stash, so is Jerry and Gerard. So, it's a lot more ownership.
Okay, so that's CJ. Here's DeMeco on how CJ is doing now with more on his plate in this offense than in the previous offense.
For sure. From that quarterback perspective, you want that ownership. You want it to be on your plate, so to speak. And CJ, he's looking forward to it. He's open to it. He wanted it, and we're here. And so I think he's done a really fantastic job so far. And Kaylee's done a really great job of working with them. They're getting on the same page, making sure the terminology, everything makes sense so we can get in and out of the huddle fast. We can play fast. We can operate clean, and we've been doing that.
That's the one thing I wonder if it was a point of contention last year. Right?
Getting in and out of the huddle?
Well, CJ having more control. Because DeMeco saying he wanted it.
He wanted it. And I kind of suspected that just by the way that CJ was talking towards the end of the season and about meetings that they were going to have or had immediately after the season. I think CJ doesn't want to be a guy that's throwing the current guy under the bus, but you have to have those open conversations about, man, there was probably times last year where we're locked into this pass protection, and then I realized that, oh, boy, I'm pretty sure the blitz is coming from the left, and we're screwed, and we don't have any answers for this, that there's nothing he could do about it, that you're trapped. You're trapped in the passenger seat in this car that's careening downhill.
Yeah.
And you don't have any control or authority to change things. And it's even if you did, the way the Texans operate last year, it was very much old school back in the day Gary Kubiak type stuff, or Mike Shanahan, not Kyle Shanahan stuff, where the play is the play. There's going to be an answer within the play, and you figure it out on the fly. And the modern NFL has just changed so much, and defenses have gotten so good at disguising coverages and disguising blitzes and looks and fronts at the line of scrimmage that I think it's really, really hard to operate at a high level when you're getting up to the line with 5 seconds left on the play clock and just telling the quarterback, good luck, don't worry, it's cool. I called the perfect play.
Yep.
And this is the right way to go because CJ mentally is 100% capable of handling it. It's just a matter now of getting the reps and as much as you can between now and the first game of the season, get CJ to a point where he can manage all the spinning plates. That's the hard part. And every time I talk about this, people say, like, no, CJ will be fine. He's smart. No, it doesn't have anything to do with that. It's a matter of how many reps have you seen and how comfortable are you doing it? It's like you can be taking a math test. Remember when you were a kid? I don't know if you had to do this, Sean. We had to do like Minuteman drills you've got these timed tests. And you might know the multiplication table, but when you have to do it, like how many can you do in 1 minute? That's what the real test is. And that's what it is with anything. Is a quarterback running an offense like that, it's one thing to know it on paper. It's another to actually go out there and do it. And that's the challenge that Kaylee has right now is, okay, how do we get him from the bunny slopes to the double diamond trail between now and September? It's a lot. It's a lot.
And you got to do all this stuff in basically, I know the play clock's 40 seconds. You got to do it all in about 25 or 30 seconds, process everything, and then do that 70 times a game. You know, it's
right. Getting in and out of the huddle quickly and up to the line of scrimmage, that was the one that I liked hearing the most from DeMeco. The other thing from DeMeco that I really liked was him talking about learning how to delegate. And I think
as a head coach,
because what were we saying last year? All right, the next step for DeMeco is, hey, you're a great defensive coordinator. Nobody questions that. How do you get Matt Burke to be the actual defensive coordinator? So when the offense really needs help and they really need your input, or you just need to sit back and analyze and really look at things. You know, there's things as a head coach. When you're the head coach of a football team, there's got to be times where you've got time to just kind of sit in your office and reflect on things for 2 hours.
Yeah.
You've got to be able to just go take a walk around the neighborhood and think about things. And when you're the full-time defensive coordinator, it's hard to do that. Yep. So one of the shifts this year is probably also, hey, how do we get Matt Burke to really be at the helm of the defense?
For sure, for sure. Speaking of the defense, let's get a defensive player's point of view on the Texans defense. Here's Will Anderson Jr. talking about Nick Kaylee's offense.
Yeah, most definitely, man. He has a lot of movements, man. He switches it up a lot, give a different lot of looks. And I'm excited. I can't wait to keep seeing what he has, man. He brings a lot of juice to this offense, a lot of juice to this team, man. And I know he's going to have those guys rolling.
Yeah. I like hearing the defense talk about the offense.
Yeah. And look, it's going to be because it's a new offense that's operating differently. The defense is going to, you know, last year it was bad in training camp. The defense just looked like they were in the playbook. And again, you kind of hear some little kind of off the record filtering throughs of the offensive guys making excuses for their bad performance in training camp by like, well, they know what's coming. All right, you know what good offenses do? The defense knows what's coming, and it doesn't matter. You execute. Right.
That's right.
Yeah, like it's just there's nothing about the defense knowing what's coming that really gives a good answer for why Mario Edwards was 5 yards deep in the backfield every single play. You guys weren't executing. You weren't getting the job done.
That was Casario who just walked by, Seth. If I just jumped off the shot there, I gave him a fist bump. He's out here at 7:30. Looks like he's the only one out here. Looks like he's getting ready to maybe pull a Lovie Smith. Remember when Lovie used to come out here and just walk for like a half hour?
Yeah. Well, remember, too, I thought about Lovie when I was talking about, you know, guy. Once you're a grizzled old man, you get kind of tired of people gushing about personality traits at the beginning of training camp because ultimately it doesn't matter. Some of that stuff, it starts to get old. Like anything that you love in the beginning gets really old really quickly. With Lovie, we called it. The first time he said sometimes divorce is a good thing, we were like, that's great. That sounds like something somebody would say sitting on a rocking chair while they're, you know, drinking a lemonade, you know, dispensing wisdom to the youth. By about the eighth or ninth time Lovie said sometimes divorce is a good thing, we're like, this guy is a serial divorcer.
every departure from the team was that.
That's a good thing. The one thing you knew about Lovie, that his marriage was rock solid at that point. You don't use that analogy all the time unless you've been married for 30 or 40 years.
Correct,
And, you know, your wife knows you're not talking about your situation individually.
Right. Now, sometimes, as someone who's been through it, sometimes it is a good thing. I can tell you that. Speaking of Casario, he just walked by here, just walked by the set. Let's hear from him. I think D'Amico and Nick are very similar, and maybe Nick more than D'Amico in this respect. If you bring up a specific player, it's really like pulling teeth to get him to be over the moon about a certain guy or like volunteer like this guy. From the time they selected Cade Stover, I think Nick Casario has been on the Cade Stover train. Here's Nick Casario volunteering yesterday that this might be one of the most improved players on the team this year.
Yeah, you'd be hard-pressed to find probably a player that's improved as much as Cade in the offseason. Really took advantage of his opportunities. He's always had the right mentality and the right approach and the right mindset. I think most young players going from year one to year two have an opportunity for growth and development, really more physically, because they kind of have a full year in the program. So as soon as the season is over, what do you do in February, March, April, May to get yourself ready for the offseason program? Cade, along with a number of other players, certainly took advantage of his opportunities. You know, we're glad Cade is here and, you know, looking forward to potentially what he can bring to our football team.
The way this team's been built, Seth, the high-level picks they've largely done really well on. Stingley's one of the best corners. Will Anderson Jr. is one of the best edge rushers. And C.J. Stroud, if he's not already, I think will be one of the best quarterbacks in football. Those are top three picks. You got to hit on those. But where they've been able to, through the draft, to kind of supplement some of these positions is you draft Kamari Lassiter with the 42nd pick, and it looks like he's got Pro Bowl potential. Kalen Bullock in the third round. Nico Collins in the third round. I'll say even Henry Toa-Toa, who you were desperate at linebacker last year once Christian Harris went out with an injury. And Henry Toa-Toa is a fifth-round pick who's out playing where he was drafted. If Cade Stover can be one of those guys in the tight end room, I'm not saying he needs to turn into Travis Kelce or anything like that, but if he because he's got the potential to be a guy that Dalton Schultz is not, where you can have him out there on running plays and passing plays, and he's got the athleticism and in the passing game, and he's got the bullishness in the run game to be that kind of guy. Like, if whatever Nick's saying about him now translates into him becoming an above average tight end in the NFL in the fourth round, you're laughing with that pick right there.
Yeah, and I think that if you look at Cade Stover, and one thing that D'Amico had talked about in the OTAs was how much better he's gotten at the top of the route. And that's where you create separation. For a guy that doesn't have incredible athleticism, you got to look at it and say, all right, well, how is a guy going to establish himself as a receiver without having those top-end physical traits? Travis Kelce is a great guy to look at. Travis Kelce, it's not his speed necessarily that separates him. It's how good he is at actual route running and using leverage, understanding defense, all of those things. But it takes a lot of work. And Travis Kelce is a guy that really, you know, after he kind of figured it out and matured, really poured it on with that. In Bill Belichick's book, he spends a good chunk of time talking about James White, the running back.
The running back.
And
yeah.
How James White was this guy that nobody would have ever expected that he might even make a team. But the fact that he worked on all of these things day after day and really understood things on a different level than other running backs, that he became a really, really valuable weapon for the Patriots. Obviously Tom Brady throwing him the ball helps. But it's all those things that you work on with the nuances of the game. I think they feel that way about Cade Stover, that he's a guy that can potentially really develop above and beyond what you might expect from his combine profile just because of his competitiveness and because of his attention to detail.
Seth, you'll like this one because Casario mentions Sean and Seth in this particular answer. We got a shout out yesterday in the press conference. Actually, it is a good answer. He was talking about kind of what are the qualities of this team that he likes the most, and he reshared an anecdote with the media that he shared with us on our show a few weeks back.
Yeah, I want to say the attitude and the approach to work. We have a lot of guys that are very diligent, and it's about the work and not really worry about a bunch of superfluous things or things on the periphery that really don't have any relevance to winning. I might have mentioned this to Sean and Seth a little bit earlier in the spring, but just anecdotally, it was a little bit later in the spring. I want to say it was sometime in June, where D'Amico and our offices are situated. The weight room's right behind us, and you have the window. So I hear just some random noise, and I kind of peek my head over my shoulder. I mean, Higgins and Noel were in there with their helmets on, catching off the jugs in the afternoon when nobody was around. So I would say that's kind of a microcosm of the team and the players that we have, and that's where we want to keep the focus. And I think our players are motivated more about just putting a good product out there and putting the work in and not necessarily worry about other things that are outside of their control.
Okay, so I mentioned that I had read the Belichick book. I read it twice in the last month, actually, because it grew on me slowly. The first couple chapters, for those of you that might try it, it's going to test you the first couple chapters. I don't know about this. Once he gets rolling, it was really good. But so much of it, as I'm reading it, I'm realizing and recognizing that, man, D'Amico and Bill Belichick are very, very similar in a lot of ways, way more so than you'd expect. And that because obviously different personality types, okay. But I think in their approach to football, like, first and foremost, D'Amico wants guys who are football junkies. Just guys that just live and breathe it. They're like comic book nerds, except with football. So just like a world-class comic book nerd could tell you the volume and edition and whichever, like, of every single thing that's ever happened in a Superman comic.
Yeah.
That's what he wants out of his football players. And I think Casario does as well, but with the GM and the head coach, there's got to be that ability to identify those types of guys. And I think Bill O'Brien theoretically wanted those types of guys, and yet would continually have all these guys on the team that were the exact opposite. I just don't think he did a great job of identifying those types of players.
Yep.
I think that Casario and D'Amico in the last 2 years, when I look down the guys, the various guys they've drafted, they fit that mold of, all right, these are guys that just, what do you do in your off time? You know, I watch old NFL games. What do you do when you're bored? Gronk is a great example of that. That for all of the stuff that Gronk, had a perception of him being because he partied all the time, he was also a guy that was just perpetually working out all the time.
Yeah.
You know, like, if he had any downtime, he was like, all right, I'm just going to do some push-ups or something. And, he was just kind of wired that way.
Yep.
And I think they've just done – remember, if you go back to, like, the third-round picks especially from back in the day through various Texans GMs and coaches, you have all these guys that, like, had huge physical upside, but just – I wasn't sure that they actually liked football all that
right.
much.
Right.
Lewis Nix, I think. It was a really likable dude and everything.
Yep.
But, like, guys like that, I don't think that they were junkies for it the way – a lot of these guys are. So that part I'm very optimistic about. You still got to go win football games at the end of the day, ultimately. But I think that's where Caserio probably in his time with D'Amico has probably really, I'm guessing, has made that same connection at times. Like, oh, these guys are, wow, he's a lot more like Belichick than I thought.
Yeah,
he would
okay.
Be. We're not going to worry about all the other junk. I don't care what the kids, I don't care what his GPA was in college. I just want the guy to be a football junkie.
Okay, a couple things. You brought up the third round picks with the Texans, I think is so poignant because that's the round where the guys are probably on the fringe of being talented enough. But they're not quite second or first. Like, you're a first-round pick, and you don't love football, you're still supremely talented. Like, I don't know how much Jadeveon Clowney was a football junkie, but he's talented enough to where he hangs around the league for 10 years, and teams are going to sign Jadeveon Clowney. You go back to the Rick Smith third-round picks, and it's Brennan Williams, who's in wrestling now. It's Sam Montgomery, who was, you know, part of the KC3. It was Braxton Miller, who thought he was Hollywood. And now you get third-round picks with Nick, and it's Nico Collins, football junkie, Tank Dell, football junkie, Kalen Bullock, you know, Cade Stover in the fourth round. Guys, like, that's a really, really good point.
Well, and then the other big, and then the next step beyond that is, it's one thing to say, okay, these are the types of guys we want to have, but ultimately, you don't give the guy credit for that to the point where he's your starter in lieu of other people because he works hard.
Correct.
It's got to be that, okay, we've identified these guys who work hard and they're football junkies and they're obsessed with it, and we see it on the field. Yep. Nick Martin was a center who was not a very good center at all, but because he stole weight room equipment or borrowed weight room equipment during COVID or whatever, because he showed that he worked hard and everything, they gave him a top five center salary.
Yeah.
Like, no. It's got to be that we're looking at all that stuff. Those are the kinds of guys we want on the team. But at the end of the day, it's that it's got to translate into play on the field.
Let's hear from Will Anderson Jr. in the next segment. There's a particular player who we've actually had multiple texts asking about that Will called a freak yesterday. It's kind of flying under the radar, and it maps to what my eye test said to me yesterday about this player. We'll have that for you coming up next. All right, Payne and Pendergast with you. Here's Will Anderson Jr. talking about what he is working on this training camp.
Yeah, man, right now my biggest one is just my jab swipe and my stab club. Those are the kind of two that I really just been wanting to work on, man. Just adding a little bit more finesse to my game, been in the corner just a little bit more. So that's kind of just like help. Janelle's been helping me with that. After practice, before practice, Coach Rod has been doing a great job. So I'm excited. I can't wait.
All right. So he's working on everything all the time, Seth. That's what we love about Will Anderson Jr. He got a little football nerdy there for my tastes. Okay, so he said he's working on his jab swipe and stab club.
Yeah, it's okay. So, Will, I don't want to try to explain this over the air without the aid of video, but ultimately, what he's talking about really is he is a speed to power type of pass rusher. You think about just get upfield and then turn it into a bull rush. That's where he's probably at his most dangerous. So, what you need to do is build off of that to the point where, when guys are anticipating that and trying to account for your power, that they get caught just, you know, bracing for the power, and then you dust them. And that's where he made a lot of progress last year. He's just got to refine a lot of that. And it's cool because you can kind of see it when you go from his first few games his rookie year to the playoffs last year. He's starting to find that rhythm to where he sets guys up and he can anticipate when guys overcommit. And and then you just leave them, you know, leaving flailing at air. And he's done a great job with that. I think and having Danielle Hunter as an influence is huge. You know, sometimes having veteran leaders as teachers can be overrated because not a lot of guys are actually all that good at doing it, or there some guys just flat out don't care. I think for Will to see Daniil and the way he operates, it reminds me of like when David Carr went to the Giants and saw how Eli Manning went about his business. You wish that David Carr could have had that early in his career. That, okay, it's one thing the coaches are telling you, you got to do it this way, you got to do it that way. But when you see a guy who's one of the most accomplished pass rushers of the last decade doing it, and you watch the way he operates, it's really easy to just try to emulate that. And aside from the actual book learning you get from him, just the process of working at it.
Okay, so that's two things we need to put in the big book of Caserio questions for next week.
Yeah.
Is one, you have to ask him about your D'Amico Belichick comp from having read the Belichick book. You have to. It's non-negotiable. You have to ask him about that.
It's on my Google Doc of questions to ask Casario.
The second one, you just talking that through with what Daniil's meant to Will, is I do wonder, like, when Casario does not make big splashes in free agency, right? We know that. Yeah. He'll the big contracts he's given out, other than Daniil, have been to guys who have been in the building already, not guys outside the building. I wonder if there's part of it, especially for someone who looks at things very analytically like Casario does, that part of the value you're getting in giving Daniil Hunter $24 million, now $36 million in his third year that they just extended him, is whatever the incremental bump is that the impact he's having on Will Anderson. I think it's undeniable. Yeah. Will says it himself. Will can't go a press conference without mentioning how closely he works with Daniil Hunter and what he's meant to him. I think not only with the physical tools, but he's talked about how Daniil Hunter has really helped kind of where Will can completely get off the page, you know, emotionally sometimes, just super hyped up, is that Will has been an appropriately calming influence for him, you know?
Well, when you look at, in the press conference yesterday, somebody asked a question of what excites you about this team, or what do you get excited about? And Will gave a very animated answer. And my thought was, the real question is, what doesn't excite you, Will? What do you not get excited? Hey, Will, how do you feel about libraries? Oh my gosh, the architecture, it's incredible. There's just sometimes I walk into a library and I'm just overwhelmed with all the choices. I defy you to find something Will Anderson can't get excited about.
Will Anderson, what do you think of Brussels sprouts? Oh man, when you put breading on a Brussels sprout, oh man. Oh, you're right. I don't think there's anything.
How do you feel about the DMV, Will? Oh, they got this automated system where it tells you which window to go to. You know, sometimes you get there and just, yeah, it's really cool.
You know, sometimes I like just standing in line because you get to talk to a lot of people. You know, you talk to a lot of people in line. I get to meet a lot of new people. Will Anderson is that's a great one. Will Anderson is the one human being who could probably find redeeming value in the DM, in the old school DMV with no computers.
With Will, I was not a pass rusher. I was a run stuffer. I'm not comparing myself to Will Anderson, the football player. But yeah, there is an element of sometimes, yeah, when you're an overly excitable guy, that you got to consciously figure out how to kind of slow things down at times.
Yeah.
And you go back to Will in his rookie year, he probably could have had 5 or 6 extra sacks where you could tell he was so hyped up right before he got to the quarterback.
Settle down, bro.
Yeah. Sometimes you just got to slow down and let the game come to you. And having Daniil Hunter, who's the ultimate, he looks like a Buddhist monk almost out there, mm-hmm, at times. The way he's like he's doing Tai Chi as, yep, opposed to Kung Fu.
Yep.
That Will having that kind of calming influence is probably really good for him.
I want to make sure we get to this before we get out, because this is what I teased into the segment. The text came from Mr. Optimistic. Said, hey, Sean, Will Anderson Jr. mentioned that Daryl Taylor is a freak. Keep your eyes out for him today. I'd love your insight on it. All right, here is the cut he's talking about from Will Anderson Jr., talking about his new teammate, Daryl Taylor.
Yeah, for me, he's a freak, man. Like, he can go out there and rush, set edges, man, get off the rock, and that's what you have to have in this type of defense. And, man, he brings all the juice, and I can't wait to see him spin, man. He's a great addition for us, man. He's going to be a really big help for us this year.
That's Will's – just real quick, Seth, that's Will. Yeah. I will say this. When I was – you know, just watching practice yesterday, and you're watching different positions, and I'm like, oh, who is 52? He looks big and rangy. Like, who is that guy? And it's Daryl Taylor, who they signed for 1 year, $5 million from the Bears.
He's very, very intriguing, because there's a potential that I think he might have been in a scheme mismatch when he was a younger player in Seattle. He showed a lot of flashes.
Yeah.
But he's the classic guy, kind of like Jason Babin back in the day. When you take him out of a 3-4 type of defense and just let him put his hand in the dirt and go, it unlocked something for Jason Babin after he left Houston, ironically enough.
Yeah,
our fellow Gen Xers and Boomers, when he said he can't wait to watch him spin, I know your first thought is, oh, spin move? No, it's a DJ analogy. You know, like spin like a DJ. It's a metaphor, yeah.
I love that. All right, folks starting to get to the field here. The sun is officially up here at the Methodist Training Center. Day 2 of Texans training camp out here today. Hopefully it's as crisp as day one, Seth. A lot of run game action yesterday and a lot of short passing game. You'd like that short game yesterday, my friend.
In the No, we'll get into that tomorrow. I need to see it for 2 days in a row. But yeah, look, so far the Texans are undefeated. So there you go.
Undefeated.
They'll remain undefeated for some weeks now.
Thumbs up, yes. And the Astros are undefeated since the Texans started training camp. So there's that. We're off to the salad days of Houston sports here. Antibodies to you, my friend.
Antibodies and spin moves to you, Sean.
Thank you, sir. That is the great Seth C. Payne. I am Sean Pendergast. We are out of time.